This is season 5 of Libya Matters. Join Ilham Saoudi, Maro Mohammed, Maro bin Abdul Razak, and Mae Thompson for a Women, Peace and Security Takeover. This season will reflect on topics including gender considerations, protections, women's rights, and their participation in political and peace processes. We will be bringing you compelling conversations with women from Libya, Afghanistan, Iran, Sudan, and other global majority countries to help us think not only about the importance of upholding the WPS agenda, but also to overcome current challenges and barriers to women in conflict and post-conflict settings. For today's episode, you're joined by me, Ilham Saoudi, and my co-host.
It's good to be back together and get the conversation rolling. As we try to bring nuance to the questions surrounding women, peace, and security in Libya, it's good to first zoom out before we can dive in.
Absolutely. I can think of no better person to do this with than our guest today, who happens to be a longstanding friend of LFJL.
And I'm honored to be able to introduce Dr. Farida Al-Alagi, who is a renowned Libyan human rights activist and tireless advocate for democracy and social development. She has extensive expertise in civil society, women's rights, and youth empowerment. She served as the senior advisor to the president of the Arab Gulf Program for the United Nations Development Organizations and director of its Women and Children Division. With a PhD in sociology, planning, and development, she is a contributing editor to the United Nations Arab Human Development Report. Dr. Farida was instrumental in the establishment of Civicus, the World Alliance for Citizens' Participation, a global alliance strengthening citizen action in civil society in areas where participatory democracy and freedom of association are threatened. She also is the founder and president of the Libyan Forum for Civil Society and serves on the International Advisory Committee for the John Hopkins Comparative Nonprofit Sector Project. She is also a member of the Board of Trustees and former executive director of the Mentor Foundation, an international youth development NGO, and sits on the honorary board of the Crans-Montana Africa Women's Forum. Dr. Farida served as ambassador and permanent representative of Libya to the European Union in Brussels in 2015 and 2016. And despite years of exile, her resilience and determination have made her a respected figure both inside and outside of Libya. Welcome, Dr. Farida, to Libya Matters, and thank you for joining us today.
Maro, I don't know, how insecure are you feeling?
Exactly.
It's truly wonderful to have you, Farida, to be totally transparent. I met Farida very early in 2011, and I was truly terrified as I had heard a lot about how, quote unquote, strong, unrelenting, and a force of nature she was. I remember very clearly that first meeting. We were in Wilton Park in the UK, and it was a forum for women from across the region. She immediately became a personal mentor to me, whether that's by her choice or not, not only because of your unbreakable resilience and in building Libyan civil society, which I had a lot to learn from, but also that you always seemed to do it in style. I remember so clearly in that trip that every time you came down, you looked impeccable. And I thought, how could she do everything and still look this good? And you said to me, I don't know if you remember, she goes, the trick is just red lipstick. The minute you put red lipstick on, everyone thinks you're serious and you mean business. And I actually do that in every meeting now. When I have a proper meeting, I find my Farida red lipstick. So welcome so much to our lives, to our organization, and to this episode today.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'm embarrassed. I think I forgot some of the NGOs or the activities or the meetings that you reminded me of Civicus. Oh my goodness. I think Civicus was my preschool educational experience, really. I owe it to many other people, to many other groups. But Civicus, my goodness, beautiful memories. Well, thank you very, very much. I'm happy that I'm joining you in this conversation today. I cannot promise that I'm going to be as resilient or as optimist or as I used to be. And I'm sure you can understand that very, very well with all, and with all what's going on, whether in Libya or in Gaza. I think the world is changing so fast everywhere by the day. And I think the momentum that we are living in, the challenges that we are facing, the promises that have been broken in various levels, the age that is hitting us. Yesterday, I was talking to a friend of mine. I told her, well, what a pity. I'm 76. I wish I'm 56. I have so many, many, many things that needs to be finished. I don't know. I kept counting the years until when I should live to finish my agenda. So I hope that we can have a nice conversation. I'm known to be bold. I can only say, I have all my life said truth to power, or to take the stage to discuss any matter. Either we are courageous, we are honest, we are professional, as much as we can, because this is what people want today.
As you know, Farida, this season we're looking at the question of women in Libya and what they face when trying to engage in public life, be that political participation, civil society, or even just on social media. We all know what that can mean in terms of pressures from family, from society, and worst case scenarios, online and physical violence. How and why do we keep going on? How do we do this work? Because I think some of the stuff you highlighted in your opening remarks very much already talked about how tiring it is, how you feel your to-do list is never ending. The world is moving at such a pace. The momentum is moving at such a pace. In a lot of what we're doing, in a lot of these conversations, we seek to do this, and we are inspired definitely by your stamina. But, you know, for you to sit here like, actually, I'm not sure about the stamina anymore. So I guess the first question is, how do you keep it so revitalized and show up and be able to speak?
Well, I'm in a roller coaster. I go to bed at night so exhausted, keep hearing the news, questioning myself, stop it. You have done it for 50, 60 years. At times it has been a challenge, at times it has been enjoyable, at times it was threatening, at times it was interesting. But then I wake up in the morning and I get the first phone call, or I decide to go to a meeting or to accept contacts from friends from different parts, particularly from Libya. Now I'm in Libya. I decided to come back and settle in Libya. And this is a big decision in my life, which I took this month, because I reached a stage where I feel I used to come backward and forward, and I have never been, totally in absence of Libya, except during the years that I was in the opposition and they couldn't come back for, of course, 40 years. But since then, since the 2011, I'm always in Libya. So I have to say that regardless of all what we are hearing, regardless of all the shortcomings, regardless of all the challenges, of all the difficulties, but every time I come back to Libya, I'm just discovering fantastic young, and not only young, fantastic women and youth, and some men as well, because I always feel that, women. I think I passed that stage. There are so many wonderful men who have been supporting me, who have been interesting, who have been encouraging, who have been opening doors, who have been respecting us. So I that gave me the hope that the movement, the change, the Libya that we want to dream of is a long way to go. It's not something that's going to happen quickly. And it's not only for Libya, it's for everywhere else. So I've been going to meetings with these young, enthusiastic, brilliant women who come from Sabha, from Sirte, from Benghazi, from Nusrata, from Nalouk, from everywhere. And these women are so, they remind me of my youth. And they really, they are the ones who gave me hope to come back and settle. And it's a big, a major decision. So I think we are, maybe the listener might be confused. On one hand, we are talking about the challenges, the difficulties, the discrimination, the unfinished agenda, the repetition that we have to have, you know, peace, security, we have to be engaged, we have to be in a different level of decision-making, we have to be in the government. And on the other hand, we are talking about the violence, the discrimination, and impossible to talk about women in politics in Libya if we don't delve into the political reality of Libya. So we have no, the political reality determines where we are heading. The fear, two or three of my friends, when they were inviting me today for to go out, I said that I'm having this interview. They said, no, don't go to interview. Be careful what you say. Don't talk. Don't let your voice be loud. Be careful. You should finish talking because you have done it for 50 years and now it's time to stop. So you see, there is this fear, this internal fear. But I'm a woman that I don't know what fear means. Even when I have been told that I have a tumor in my brain, I told the doctor, tumor, impossible. He said, well, I said, do I have to be operated? I said, yes. He told me, yes, you have to be operated. I said, okay, doctor, let me be operated tomorrow. And he almost fainted. He said, tomorrow? No, I'm not telling you that you are dying tomorrow. You have to tell your husband, your family. I said, I'm not telling anybody because I'm not going to die for a simple reason. I have been fighting for democracy, for human rights, for children's rights, for women's rights, for corruption, against corruption. I cannot go now. I have an agenda to finish. So I will live. So the power of positive thinking worked with me, and I lived. So I'm in a roller coaster. I go up with hopes, then I go down, back to the reality that hits me. Then I pull myself again, and I push myself up again. And I think, despite all what I've gone through in my 70 years, because I am saying 70 years, you know why? Because I started my demonstrations in the streets of Libya when I was 6 years old. So, oh my God, I'm just calculating it now when I'm talking to you. Imagine the patience that I have. When I was 6 years old, I was marching in the streets of Libya for the Palestinian cause. Imagine. And now where we are today. So I don't know. I think, you know, the older I get, the more I get more, because I don't think I will be imprisoned or I will be blamed. Maybe people will say she's getting very old and she's no longer catching her ideas together or putting her ideas together. But I'm waiting when I'm going to stop doing all this business. I don't think I will ever stop until I'm 100 years old. I hope I will live 100 years old, inshallah.
Please, okay. Please do, and please don't. Please live to 100, and please don't stop. Just listening to you now, you mentioned so many things that I want to kind of take a moment because, you know, you talked about how you started marching at 6. You talked about how you were in exile because you were in the opposition. You talked about the feeling of optimism you felt when you came back in 2011 and the work that you've been doing since. And although we're looking at these obviously from your journey, but to me, your journey is the most beautiful version of modern Libya's journey in the sense of what we can learn and think about. And so if we take that period and those stops that you mentioned along the way and try to focus on what would you say were like the key milestones or key achievements along that trajectory that allowed you to find that optimism to move forward, you know, because I think we all need that once in a while to be reminded of where the successes are, because like you say, there's so many challenges and there's so many risks and this, the political situation is so problematic that we need to kind of take a moment and reflect in this journey for women having a more clear role in politics, a more visible role in politics. What would you say were the key milestones in Libya's history that were successes for this journey?
It's obvious all the theories on early childhood and the first 6 years of our life. Now, the research on the brain of children has proved that 60 to 70% of our personality is shaped from 0 to 6. So I think, thank God to my father and mother, who really have implanted in me from the first 6 years of my life, lots of love, lots of security. And as I told you, I went to the Catholic Church in the good old days when we had no discrimination about going to church or going to the mosque. We had Italians, we had the Jews living in Libya at that time. My best friends in my childhood were Libyan, Italian, Jewish. The discrimination that we never felt or been surrounded by, like what we are living these days. So I went to the church, and I always repeat this behavior of my father. The first day when I came back, I was practicing how to pray in front of the mirror. And my father comes in the room, and he saw me, and he tapped on my shoulder, and he said, "He's one God." So since that age, I have been believing, in respecting different religions, different nationalities, different groups, so that was the start, the beginning. And then for sure, in Tripoli, we had so many different nationalities living with us. It was an open city, an open town. And then in the school, we had the best teachers, best friends. So I think I'm a strong believer, and thank God I have been so lucky to be surrounded in all my life, my journey, with lots of love. I'm a believer in love. Love makes miracle, be it in your family, be it among your friends, be it in your profession, because love brings, the energy, the positivism, the honesty, the courage, the caring, the tolerance, all what we talk about, we start, getting it from the environment where we live. And then definitely the University of Benghazi, Gerry Yunus, that was the beginning. And many of us, when I joined the university, was in the 60s. And the 60s, as all of you know, it was the beginning of the Arab Renaissance, the Arab unity, the culture, the hope, the dream of the new nations, the end of the colonizers in many Arab countries. So that was also a major contributing factor that has been shaping my thinking. But then Benghazi University. In Benghazi, it was really the beginning of my takeoff to politics, to women's rights, to human rights, to opposition. Despite my family were part of the king's era, but I was all the time also in the opposition. I was in the demonstration. We wanted to have, that was the peak of Arab nationalism. We wanted to have, different rulers, different. And then in Benghazi, we had the best of the best of the best of teachers. Our professors were fantastic.
And as I listen to your story, one of the things that strikes me is how Libyan it is. And I say this because a lot of the times we are told that the Human Rights Project, the Women's Project, the Democracy Project is a Western idea, right? But then I hear your story, and we hear stories all the time that actually, no, it was the multiculturalism of Tripoli. It was the rebelliousness of Benghazi, those are the things together that have brought these ideas to you. And I think if we think about it in those terms, a lot of what we're facing today, or women today are facing, is this concept that being an active citizen, or what we're demanding of as an active citizen, or to be part of the country, is not natural to us or our culture or our society. But that's obviously not the case. And if I want to kind of take a specific angle on that, because so much of your work centers around this idea of creating responsible citizenship and active citizenship and being part of building democracy, not just participating in it, I come to some philosophical questions of my own. And I guess one of them is, as we're trying to build a new concept of that in this stage in Libya, is citizenship a right? Is it a privilege? Does it come with obligations? Is it unconditional? Like, how would you define being a citizen in the most full way in your mind?
Well, let me go back to what you have, to your previous comments about human rights, justice, democracy, all of this. Again, many of us in the early 60s and 70s, when I went first to the United States for my education, the Statue of Liberty was, you know, a symbol of really liberty. And then when I was in the United States, the justice, the human rights, the freedom, the equality, the emancipation, all these noble values, I'm sorry to say, I believe in these noble values, but these days are all shattered. The game is over, particularly when we are witnessing the killing of thousands of young children in Gaza. The 7th of October and what's happening in Gaza is going to reshape so many things, so many positions, so many thinking. Even in my opinion, the time has come for Arab women and women internationally. I think a new revolution needs to be brought in to really rethink that we need to be courageous enough to say that the thinking and the admiration of the Western women, of course, I will not generalize because I have to salute at this point all the great human voices that are marching in the streets of New York, of Los Angeles, of Europe, of Africa, of Latin America, supporting the Palestinian cause for freedom from these atrocities that they are enduring these days. So it is very sad to realize that the hypocrisy and the contradiction, contradictory, you know, to the point where I hope one day we can really have a very valuable, serious study to evaluate all this international funding that is coming to liberate Arab women, Muslim women. And I'm no longer spending my time. I refuse to go to any conference and spend my time talking about our Islam and Arab women, and, you know, because for 50 years we have been talking about that, and the same, you know, questions are being repeated over and over and over and over, wasting our time. In our region, what's happening now in our region, I think maybe we need to reshuffle our thinking about, we need to get the women's discussion from the closed doors of women's talking to women's, to women talking about the future of the Arab world, the future of democracy, the future of that we shape, that we define, that we understand. So citizenship, of course, citizenship, yes, of course, citizenship, we belong to a nation that gives you and considers you as a citizen. Of course, we have to admit that we lack full citizenship in its ideal model. I mean, our rights, our freedom, our contribution, our lack of fear, as I said earlier, that's still a bottom, that's still a problem. But when I hear that now in France or Germany or England, they are asking citizens not to wear a Palestinian scarf, or to say stop genocide now, or people are afraid. I have many, many friends who are foreigners and who live in Europe, and they keep telling me, Farida, we are scared. Even we used to wear the Palestinian kufiya, we cannot wear it anymore. So a new world, it's a totally new era. So with this new radical transformation, we all need to stop and rethink what comes first. So in my opinion, what comes first now is really to wake up as Arabs and to be proud of whatever many they made us all the time feel that we are inferior, and they are the superior who want to show us, who want to guide us, who want to teach us, who want to tell us. Now it's about time that they have to be humble and to leave us alone, and to respect where we have our culture, we have our norms. Yes, we have our difficulties. They have their difficulties. Yes, we have our own shortcomings. They have their own shortcomings. But for sure, the future is not going to be like the past. And thank God to the social media. Thank God to technology. Thank God that the secrecy that they kept us blind, not knowing the truth of many things that have been taken care going on, are no longer secrets. So, and we're still waiting for more secrets, for more Pandora boxes to be opened, and for us to be surprised. We have a long way to go. We have lots of, but I am, that's why, Ilham, you remember I told you, I am in a process where I'm rethinking what should be my priorities, where I should focus, where I should, even when I was thinking where I want to move. I live in Lebanon, and because of the political situation, I was thinking where I have to go. If Lebanon explodes, where I have to go? I was thinking, many friends were telling me, oh, come to Europe. No, I'm not that. Then I said, I'm going back to Libya. I'm going to spend the rest of my life in Libya. And I love it with all the difficulties, with all the problems, but I love it. It's my country. I feel my belonging. I feel that the young Libyan and the many friends that I'm meeting and working with and learning from, and so I think, you know, God knows what next is going to happen. I'm a bit pessimist. Unfortunately, Libya, for sure, our dreams after the revolution is not coming true. The instability is still going on. The corruption is still going on. The wrong people in the wrong places are still leading the country, many of them. The brilliant, capable, courageous Libyan citizen that genuinely want to contribute and they just don't want to sit and criticize are put aside. Many think that, you know, when I talk anything positive about Libya, they tell me, oh, let us come back to you after 5, 6, 7 months and see how you are going to speak. Because you are not yet.
I mean, I'll admit, I was thinking that like you've only been there for 1 month, but that's kind of part of the game, right? Making you feel that after 6 months you'll give up is exactly what these politicians that you're talking are banking on. It's what they're relying on. It's relying on the fact that even the well-intentioned, determined, will get exhausted after 5 or 6 months. And I think that's the status quo they're relying on. And I think that's what's interesting listening to you, but also as we all, you know, there's three Libyan women on this call who constantly we think about this dynamic of at what point we leave exile, at what point we stay in exile, what's the value of one over the other. There's a certain amount of comfort that those in power get from the frustrations of the practicalities of moving back. And I think the more people sort of debunk that as well, I think it becomes a really interesting conversation when they can't rely on the fact that, you know, Farida, she's used to the nice life in Beirut, and after a while she's going to get bored of the romance of coming home. That's what they want.
Nice life, for sure. I love to sleep at 9:30 and wake up at 6 in the morning. No, you see, but, yeah. I wish I enjoyed that part. No, Ilham, you see, it is the destiny from God, you know. I'm led by that, I don't think I will ever get tired from Libya or I leave Libya again, because it came in this juncture after 7th of October, after what's happening globally, after witnessing the chaos in Europe, after witnessing the hypocrisy and the broken promises. So you know what I'm noticing in Libya now? Many, 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 many women and many youth are really doing their own business and letting this politician solve their problems aside, okay? I think, can you hear me? Yeah. So I noticed that there are so many young women in sports, young women in culture, young women in music. Many young women are in business, small businesses, lots of art, lots of writers, musicians. So there is, you know, in Medina Qadima, the old town, totally renovated. When I go there in the afternoon, I meet all these fantastic writers, musicians, poets. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful feeling. So I think the world is changing. And many of us, you are still young. All I can tell you, the best blessing that God gave me, I think, maybe I was very lucky, I have been always on the positive thinking side. Despite all what happens, I've always been calming myself down to say, everything takes time. We cannot rush change. Change takes time. I've been waiting for change now for six, 7 years. Okay, you younger generation after me, you will continue. I know that I will not live to see my dreams for Libya or for the Arabs or for humanity. Humanity is lost these days. Thank God this demonstration does this bring humanity back together. Otherwise, you know. And then we have been planning, strategizing, training, talking about justice, talking about democracy, talking about the human rights, conferences, research, name it for 50, 60 years. But then everything is evaporated. So are we going to continue to do the job the same way, the way we have been doing it in the last 20, 30 years? And it has not led to the change that we need. So now we need a leap. And the leap needs a new thinking. And the new thinking is that we need to get out of our comfort zone of just do this 3-4 days workshop or do this 3-4 days meeting or this conference or this blah, blah, blah. And life is continuing to be the same. So this is in my opinion, applies to women because we just cannot continue to do the business. We need new methodologies. We need new thinking. We need to be humble to stop and evaluate and rethink. We need to be admitting our mistakes, what went wrong, why it's easier to repeat what you are used to do than to risk to try something totally new.
And I think, Farida, with regards to kind of now focusing in a little bit more on the way forward for Libya, and like you had mentioned, right, that this has been going on for so long. I mean, you started 70 years ago. And times are changing and we're still kind of fighting that good fight. And, you know, with everything happening today, and like you mentioned, social media, you know, the revolution didn't pan out the way we had expected in Libya, but we're still pushing and we all still do believe that we can change course eventually. And so besides your own journey and what kind of continues, you know, what do you do to continue that self-motivation to continue? But how do you engage the youth, right? There's also a disenfranchised population or populations inside of Libya. And that's where the question of citizenship also comes in, right? It's that ownership. It's the belonging. I belong here. This is for, you know, I have a right to be here. I have a right to demand the space. What with the youth today, where a lot of them, or the young women and men as well, that went out to the streets in 2011 and find that largely a lot of it has been hijacked. How do you continue to engage, and how do you continue with this younger generation to motivate them and empower them to keep, you know, this movement moving forward.
Yeah. You remember when I said, when we say youth, and when we say women, we cannot all pack them in one group. So many different kinds of youth, okay? And I encountered so many of them. On one hand, unfortunately, youth are more now, many of them, without generalizing, inclined to find a job, inclined to travel, inclined to have a beautiful car, inclined to have a visibility, to enjoy life. And sadly enough, many of these youth have been co-opted by the different governments, different militias, different groups, different fundamentalist groups. Some youth are in desperate needs also to controlled ideologically by different groups for different reasons. But on the other hand, you have this beautiful, beautiful, promising, brilliant young leaders that are very different from us, and I don't believe that we need to preach them, because many of them, we need to be humble to learn from them. We need to guide them. This gives hope, and there are many of them are into businesses, different businesses. They are into art. They are into civil society. But what concerns me at this stage, and I keep telling them that, there is competition among them as well. And this is among the illnesses that we are enduring, not only in Libya, in many, many countries, because they work in many other countries, not only in the Arab world, internationally. There is this, the selfishness, the lack of coordination, the lack of learning. So what concerns me with many Libyan youth, so some of them are really brilliant, capable, funded. I will come to the funding agencies, to the United Nations, who's playing, because we need also to see who is really playing a major role in shaping Libya's present and Libya's future. Libya's future and Libya's present is not totally in the hands of Libya. We have so many, and I'm sure you know that, you know, the international intervention in Libya is really controlling our future, controlling. They choose whom to be in touch with, whom to listen to, whom to avoid, whom to silence, whom to, particularly if you are a little bit criticizing them or saying the truth. They don't like that. So I think there's lots of work that needs to be done among youth. Youth, they are still finding their ways. Many of them are very frustrated. Many of them, their dream is just to leave Libya. But many, many of them are now back, and they are with their own businesses, engineers, doctors, artists, writers, sports. And by the way, I can tell you something as well. I think despite all the mess and all the confusion that we are hearing about the Libyan economy, more and more opportunities are being found now. More and more businesses on a smaller scale are going on, but, you know, limited, but at least, you know, starting. If it will, they will continue, I don't know. But definitely the political map is very, very, very alarming to me still.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, like you said, what the reality is right now is I haven't been back since 2014, so I can't really say. But from anecdotally, what I hear from friends and family, the situation is very much kind of geared towards these opportunities, right? In terms of economic opportunities, businesses, there's more space growing. But I think ultimately, the fear, at least the way I see it, is that people do become a bit more disillusioned with engaging in change on the political, on, you know, on the civic, civil society side, that because, you know, there are dangers in engaging in that space, or it's not a lucrative space necessarily. And so you can do a lot more and gain a lot more if you just disengage from that. And so engaging women and the importance of bringing in, you know, women's voices to the political process, to, you know, and not only for a snapshot of a moment at a table, but that engagement that remains, that is engaged in the long run. Women have to be a part of it today, and they have to be a part of it tomorrow, and continue to be voiced in this process. And like you said, I absolutely agree. The international community does handpick, right? And international players do handpick individuals and how they play out in their participation in this process. But circling back to the importance of women's participation, why is it so important that we encourage and continue to facilitate or expect that space is you know, has women and women's voices in there?
Because it has been proven you cannot build a nation with 50% of its population. Libyan women represent 49% of the total population of Libya, or almost 7 million. Secondly, Libyan women, I hope that Ilham one day, I want to really to have a conversation about the history of Libyan women. Can you believe it or not? Since 1835, then in 1911, then during the Italian occupation, women have been fighters, women have been engaged, women. So much about women's involvement in the Libyan history is not known to many Libyan, many Libyan and to many foreigners as well. So the woman's engagement, and as you know, we have lots of Bedouin in Libya. And I've done my PhD dissertation on the decision-making power of women in Kufra, in the Libyan desert. And they were the strongest and the most capable ones. And I recall meeting this grandma who told her son they moved into a new, from the desert to a new settlement project. So I wanted to see the power of decision-making when they were in the desert and when they moved. And I found this old lady sitting on the dust, and there was a cow next to her. And this grandma was telling me a story that she threatened her son if he will not allow her granddaughters going to the school, they opened a new school, if he will not allow his granddaughter to go to the school, she forbids him from coming to her to bury her in the grave when she's dead. And as you know, in our culture, the grandmothers have a very, very powerful position. Whatever grandma's orders, you know, things goes on. So I told her, but why? Why you are telling him? Why you want your granddaughters to go to the school? She said, you know why? Because I am dying. I am getting very, very old. And she pointed to the cow. She said, this animal can kick. When she's angry, she can kick. I could not kick nothing. And only education will guarantee that my granddaughters will be strong women. And this is in the middle of the desert in the 70s, in the mid-70s when I was finishing my PhD dissertation. And of course, my findings, I will not go into details about that, but my findings was that when these women were in the desert, were more powerful decision maker, taking care of everything. When they moved them to a modern new settlement projects, they became just cooking and sitting and having children. So women are strong. They are really strong, to be honest with you. Poor women, oh, poor, oh, they're, you know, when I was doing my dissertation, you know, in one of the little towns in the areas where I was studying all these groups of women, imagine among the Tuareg, yeah, in the Tuareg culture, if the man will shout not to hit, no man ever raises his hand and hit a woman. He's not respected. He will be kicked out of the tribe. So if he raises his voice or he shouts to her, she leaves the house. She goes to her parents' home and she will ask for divorce. And they were so surprised. Many women that I met, they are married twice, three times. This married to this, this was divorced from this, then she went back to him. And stories. I'm a Libyan and I'm from there. But I was so surprised. And then she will never go back to him unless he brings to her a gift. And the gift is usually gold for him. And he apologizes to her. So this, I mean, I'm just bringing these stories to tell you that this over-exaggeration and over blah, 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 woman violence, law about woman violence, violence, look everywhere, violence. So all I have to tell them, we really swallowed the human rights and the democracy and the justice and the transparency and lack of women's rights and the poor Muslim women who are really victims. Yes, they are, like in the West. I lived in the West. I worked with many women from different parts of the world. I know the stories very, very well. So women, there isn't a single country or nation in the whole universe.
Hello, my name is Rahima, communications officer at LFJL. In this LFJL Explains, I will be talking about the journey of the women's movement in Libya and highlighting some key turning points. From the Italian occupation period of Libya between 1911 and 1943 to the more recent post-Gaddafi era, women have played a varying but fundamental role in shaping the country. Starting in 1955, Libyan women began forming women's associations and groups, at the same time gaining more opportunities to participate in politics and gain the right to vote by 1964. Then from 1969 under Gaddafi's rule, Libya saw some shifts in gender laws and policies, such as the 1969 Constitutional Proclamation of Equal Rights for both men and women and equal pay. Yet under the surface, Gaddafi constructed an illusion of women's liberation in policy that was not reflected in practice. Many rights on women did not progress. In addition to the new restrictions imposed on the independence of Libyan women, including employment and political representation. Fast forward to the 2011 uprising, there was a transformational shift where Libyan women took their solid place at the forefront of the revolution. Many women led demonstrations and were active on social media, documenting the abuses and violations that were taking place at the time. In the post-Gaddafi era, Libyan civil society began to develop and once again, women played a central role. It was estimated recently that women make up more than half of those working within Libyan civil society. With the growth of women's groups and organizations promoting and protecting women's rights. And today, women make up an estimated 55% of Libya's 2.7 million registered voters. However, despite this, women's rights defenders and women's organizations are under attack today, targeted for their work by non-state actors, including fundamentalist religious groups, as well as state authorities. To find out more about the women's movement in Libya, check out our website, libyanjustice.org.
That puts women one step ahead of men. Discrimination is across the board, discrimination in different countries. The participation of women in politics is still really minimal everywhere. I hope that now, with what's happening, with the mess that's happening globally, with the new global order and international order, whatever is going to come out, that we need definitely more women in power. The right women, the good women, not the corrupt women, because we have many women who have been in politics, but unfortunately they disappointed us in many countries. So it's not just any woman. I would rather have a man that really is ethical.
I'm going to take a moment here because this is the thing that gets under my skin the most, because it's almost like we expect men to be corrupt and problematic. And so it's okay if a man's corrupt because that's kind of Like, that's really what politics is really about. And if we get a good man, then it's incredible and we support them. And the rules are flipped when it comes to women, that for you to get support as a woman and for you to be accepted as a woman, for you to have a chance as a woman, you almost have to be an angel. And I struggle with that. And I'll tell you why, because I think that is exactly the narrative that has always been used to keep women away from even experimenting with politics. Because, you know, I begin with myself, and I know tens of women who don't go into politics because I'm like, oh, if I go into politics, they're going to look in my, you know, they're going to look at everything. They're going to bring something. They'll find something. They'll stress my parents. They'll stress my father. They'll go after my daughter in a way that no man ever thinks about. And we create all these barriers for women to enter, because for you to be able to even enter the field, you have to be above perfection. My position is, frankly, we as women are entitled to have as many bad women politicians as we get male politicians. Why are we attributing the double standard to women when it comes to this in a way that we've never, ever, ever held men to that standard? And so if I have a corrupt male politician, I don't mind if it's a female politician, because that's a, in some way, that's a measure of genuine parity, right? That you're not, you're just judged on your performance as opposed to your performance in the context of your gender. And I think for me, like, one of the things I hear the most when we work with women activists and women who have political aspirations is that same narrative is being used for them not to put themselves forward. Like, I'm not going to participate because I don't have the experience. Well, obviously you're not going to have the experience until you participate. Or I don't have the credentials. Obviously you don't have the credentials because you've not been given the favoritism that men have had by being made ambassadors, by being made ministers, by being made junior ministers. And so, you know, for every bad female politician we can name, I'm sure we can name 5 to 10 equally problematic male politicians, but that's acceptable. But it's not acceptable for women. And so I think if we're genuinely going to be talking about a new global order or a new way of looking at things or a new age, it's that your failure or your success has nothing to do with your gender. And it's okay, you know, ideally we want good politicians, full stop, not just good female politicians and the males we expect it from. And I think that's the bit that, you know, as we're doing the season and as we're talking to people, it's a theme that seems to come up quite regularly, that we need to get good women into political positions. That is absolutely correct, but no more so than getting good men into those same positions.
Yeah. I can see your points. I agree partially with it. But when I'm saying, my principles is to refuse corruption, to fight corruption, to make sure that the government, the transparency, the honesty, the ethics are there for men and women, for men and women. But when you have, and this is the reality, okay, that does not mean that we don't have to have women who have to make mistakes or have, but not to be corrupt. And they are not angel, I agree with you. And they can make some mistakes, but because particularly when you are in a nation that is just opening the doors for women, and when you are getting all these women who are, again, as literate in politics or as corrupt as men are, I can find it very, very difficult, okay? It is not that they have to have the angels, but this is the principle. And not only that, because also it has been proven that the majority of women who go into politics are much capable and much cleaner and much engaged in really doing the quote-unquote what they need to do to their countries than men are, okay? So, yes, women are human. They have to go into the political arena and experiment and learn. But for me in person, to be honest with you, I have difficulty, men or women, and I know that I'm too idealistic in this, because particularly in politics, and that's why many women and many good men, even in Libya today, many women and many good men who are asked to take political position, they refuse. Because, you know, they say we don't have the tools that we can handle this reality of leadership or of political engagement, Okay. So it is not easy. It is not easy. It's very challenging.
And I think as we look at sort of challenges, I think that's a challenge. And I might just take a moment there as well, because, you know, if you look at the career of a woman in public life in Libya, there is the entry point, which is what we've been talking about, right? What are the standards we're expecting of women to participate? There's the fact that in the time that you are in public space or in politics, the males will always sacrifice you. A, because you're easier to sacrifice, and B, it makes the point that women aren't ready. And then I guess the final part is your exit from politics effectively ends your ongoing career for a lot of these women in a way that, again, it doesn't happen for men. And I mean, ignore just any of the, so we don't end up naming names, but, you know, some of the stories we see, the exact same crime of corruption occurs. The example that is made of is the woman ambassador as opposed to the male ambassador. It's the woman minister instead of the male, because that serves this narrative that women cannot do this job. They're not tough enough. It's not because in that instance, that person, that individual woman was the only one who was corrupt. It's part of a system, right? And I think the women that are selected are precisely selected because they can play in that system. Because even if we think about the entry point of women, well, really at the moment, the gatekeepers are still the men. So the women that we're talking about have all been appointed by these men. They're not people who've been elected. We haven't had an election in a long time. So of course they're going to select women, A, that are willing to sacrifice some of their ethics or morals, if that's the language we want to use, but also for which there is a deal that's been done that they will be the ones sacrificed for the greater good. And if we're then thinking, okay, how do we counter this when we're trying to create a new generation that is ethical, that is moral, to see that politics is actually about engaging? And you're 100% right, Farida, when you're saying that this is a global phenomenon. You know, my daughter is 8 years old. She's, you know, lived and born in this country. Her only reference point of politics is what she's seen in the UK. And she's very clear that politics is a failure based on that, to the point that if any of us in our home do anything where we say something and then we do the opposite, she says, don't be a Boris, in reference to Boris Johnson, because in her mind, politicians don't follow through on what they say. They break the rules. And so I think it's a global phenomenon of how you get people to actually see politicians as anything but corrupt at this stage and wherever you are. I give the example because it shows this whole kind of false narrative that the West has somehow got something to teach us about running states. I 100% agree with you that that's one of the few possible turnarounds we'll see in this period. But I think when we look at it from the perspective of women's participation, it's something that I'm always checking how I speak as well, because I fall into the trap, and I'm sure Marwa, you fall into the trap, and you as well, where we start holding women to a higher standard, which then creates further barriers of entry for women. And so how do we flip that? How do we take, you know, we recognize that challenge. We recognize we all feed into it by the pressures we put on women for being, you know, being nuclear scientists to be able to kind of be noticed, or being really kind of leaders in their field to be noticed, in a way that we have men who don't even know how to read and write properly, like vying for the same positions as them. How do we address that barrier of entry that is so easy to fall into, because it's legitimate? It's a legitimate barrier, but it's only applied in one specific way. So when we're thinking about women that we're working on, or with women working with, or women that, you know, you work with and we together, and we start thinking of, you know, how we support people wanting to enter politics, that we don't end up unintentionally creating further barriers.
I just wanted to add one thing to that, Farida, before you answer. In terms of kind of picking up on what Ilham was saying, that the way the system is designed now is that women's entry point really is through the men as well, right? So going back to kind of that sense of belonging, that right to be there as well, right? It's almost, we've granted you this. It's a favor. And I think that once we start flipping it and we say, no, but I have a right to be here equally. I'm not waiting for the men to be the gatekeepers, but this is half of, you know, this is my country too, and I can sit there. But I also think that we do have, you know, a general kind of approach where, all right, we need to kind of pick up a few women, put them in this, in these positions, and they're always like these snapshots. So how do we ensure that it's also a mental approach as well?
Well, that's why, if you recall earlier, to be honest with you, there are so many complicated societal restrictions. Let me focus on Libya. I myself, when I was representing Libya in the European Union, I resigned 4 months after I started my job, and then they kept calling, telling me, no, please wait, no. Because I couldn't swallow the hypocrisy and the illiteracy and the game player inside the European Union, and they couldn't accept also from what I'm observing in the Libyan government. So I cannot also stay in a position just to stay in a position where it's against my principle, my ethics, my values, my commitments, my vision. Today, okay, in Libya, and not only Libya, now I've been meeting, talking with so many women. Why many intelligent, capable, strong women are outside politics? Why? Some of the reasons, Ilham, you have been talking about, but others, many women will say, we cannot be in circles where we are only figures, where we are just saying, Her Excellency the Minister, because we are stripped from any decision-making. We are just a window showing like a decor. And we cannot accept that. So this is the dilemma. That's why where we need to change the order. When you have a political system that you have no transparency, no election, so much competition, so many wrong people in positions of power, so many lack of transparency. We don't know what's going on. Many. And then what really hurts me very, very much today in Libya, we have so many divisions. Rumors. You cannot trust, the first thing when I came to Libya, don't trust this, don't trust that. They are not saying the truth. Be careful. Don't be naive. Don't say your secrets to this. And then the few women who made it to positions of power, no one talked to the other. Competition, the hit and run shows. When you come to see, oh, there are conferences, there are meetings, there's tons of research, there are so much training. If all of this is going taking care, going on for the last 11, 12 years, and millions is being spent of money, why we are where we are? That we don't have yet, we don't have, can you believe it or not, we don't have a single comprehensive, scientific, holistic, professional strategy for a Libyan woman in the next 5 years. Everything is fragmented. Everything is superficial. The research that's being done, there is lots of research, lots of civil society doing meetings, but it is lacking professionalism, it is lacking strategic vision, it is lacking innovation. So that's why I think we need, we don't need the national reconciliation is not only among the politicians. We need national reconciliation among different civil society groups, among different activists, among different youth, among different women. We need this genuine new thinking that we need to invest in and work on. And we need also to advise the donors. The donors are contributing to this mess that we are continuing. We don't have transparency with civil society. We don't know what money is being given to what, for what reason. We don't have evaluation. We don't have measuring impact of all what this money where it has been going on. We don't have transparency. We don't have, so we don't have a law for civil society. I myself have been working on it when I went back to Libya since 2011 with many groups of other Libyan women and men. but we reach no solution, we reach nowhere. So unfortunately, it's not only the government that's being corrupted. Even part of the civil society is being corrupted. The gaps are very, very, very huge between the research institutes, the policymakers, the activists on the ground, the civil society. Everybody's singing his song alone. That cannot go. That cannot continue, or cannot enjoy it if the methodology that we're using continues to be the same.
No, and I think that brings us to the core of, you know, the themes really that we've been exploring for a while on Libya Matters, which is effectively, it all comes down to accountability. Whether it's the first thing we think about is accountability is always, you know, courtrooms, etc. But really, the real accountability that builds societies is the sort of small letter A, right? It's the accountability of every single person who's part of a project to take accountability for their own role in that, whether that's the politicians, whether that's the international actors, the donors, for sure, whether it's, you know, civil society actors at the different levels. You know, I can speak for the organization we represent, which is Lawyers for Justice in Libya, where we recognize not only that we're responsible for our own actions, but the actions we support and we fund as well, because we do sub-fund and all this kind of stuff. And I think really the importance of that lowercase or small letter A accountability is that, to me, is where trust is built. And when you build trust, that's where you build a society, because you know that in your day-to-day life, any interaction you have is a safe interaction because people are accountable. Whether that's because you know how to report someone who sexually harasses you on the street, or whether you know that someone will pay their taxes, that will mean the street gets fixed. And all these small bits of accountability are really where societies are built. And that speaks to one of the very first themes you brought up. And I think that brings us nicely kind of full circle to how this conversation started, as we draw to an end, is it is a culture that we're trying to build, right? It's not just a movement. The reason you started off on your trajectory is because you had a family that instilled in you certain cultural values that, you know, that people, that diversity is a value, that inclusion is a value, that education is a value, that understanding is a value. And I think that's where, when we look at accountability in the biggest sense of the word, or we look at democracy in the biggest sense of the word, or any of these great ideals that we talk about with such passion, really it's that application on the personal that changes things. And I think that's where we talk about, okay, we're talking here about a movement, yes, a political movement, yes, but also a cultural change, which takes a lot of work. And so as we kind of try to conclude with some positivity for our audience, and if we can just think kind of in terms of really three key ideas, as you know, and to try and keep them sort of really memorable and short so that our audiences can take them with them as kind of the homework from this episode. What are the three priorities or the three areas that you think deserve the most attention in Libya at the moment for women to be part of this, the future?
Keep working hard. Don't give up. Be patient. Change takes time. Maybe 10, 20, 30 years. Change does not happen after a meeting or a conference or a training or whatever. Work together. Coordinate together. Keep being transparent, be honest, be courageous, and be open, and be humble.
Thank you so much, Farida. We'll do the debunking section where we'll just give you one sentence, and we want your like instinctive reactions to statements we hear a lot about Libya or about the process or about women. Yeah.
Okay, so the sentence is, there aren't enough Libyan women who can do politics.
You are kidding me. Every single woman is doing politics, starting in their house to the whole society. No, everything is politics.
I love it. Okay. The second one, which I've personally heard, women in Libya are not interested in power.
Oh, are you joking me? In power where? Power in politics, or power in their house, or power in the society, or power what? No, they are interested. Of course, few of them are interested, but they are powerless. They're not given the chance. Women are powerful. Women are cunning. Women are strong. Women are capable. Women are, maybe they're too humble to hide their brilliance and their the domination of men. But no. I told you about that grandma who wanted to have granddaughters to be educated, and she wanted them to be powerful and educated. Women in Libya are beautiful, are fantastic. They have so many shortcomings, but I love them. They're fantastic. And the good and the bad are everywhere. The good, I work with so many women on the international level. I have seen all kinds of women. So, like I've seen all kinds of men. And, you know, so we don't hate men or want to criticize men and say all women are the best. If woman comes, it's going to be a better world.
It's been inspiring. Thank you so much.
Farida. We need a dose. Like a nice little dose.
Thank you, Marwa. Thank you very much.